Yo, it's time we stop waiting to mobilize, man. We gotta beat a move. I said ain't nothing, no guarantee. You want it, you better bleed. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave. Ain't nothing, no guarantee. You want it, you better bleed. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave. Ain't nothing, no guarantee. You want it, you better bleed. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave. Ain't nothing, no guarantee. You want it, you better bleed. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave.
You are now listening to Talk That Lit, the place where we talk about books and more. Today we're joined by a very special guest, former South Carolina House of Representative and author of the New York Times best-selling book, My Vanishing Country, Bakari Sellers. Bakari, welcome to the show.
Oh man, thank you for having me. I'm excited about this opportunity as well, bro.
Thank you. So I just want to get started. My Vanishing Country is, if not, definitely my favorite book that I've read this year so far, if not one of my favorite books I've ever read. How have you, you know, processed the response to your book and the success of it alongside the current state of our country?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a really good question because it's one that I probably wouldn't have guessed I'd be asked, 4.5-5 weeks after the book's released. No one wants to release their book during the middle of a pandemic. And so there was a bit of angst about it. It came out on Malcolm X's birthday, May 19th. When you put a book out in the middle of a pandemic, you're unsure of what would happen. Bookstores are closed. So I could have never guessed that we would have Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, David McAtee, and George Floyd at it. And although the book is evergreen, and, you know, if it would have come out 4 months earlier or 4 months later, we still would have been talking about state-sanctioned violence against people of color. And we still would have been talking about, healthcare disparities that we're seeing that's causing black folks to die at higher rates from COVID. God makes no mistakes. This moment was meant for a book like My Vanishing Country, and I'm glad that people are responding to it the way they are.
The way you introduce the book or your story really shapes, you know, sets the foundation for, you know, how your life has developed over the years. And you start by sharing about where you grew up in Denmark, South Carolina, and also a date that, you know, that is very important to how you were raised. Can you get into a little bit of both of those?
Yeah, so Denmark is my home. And, I come from a very poor rural community, but we were very rich in love and very rich in experiences and very rich in community. February 8th, 1968, the Orangeburg Massacre, where three young men were killed, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and Delano Middleton. And my father was shot along with 28 others. It's a day that rings loudly in my heart, in my head, in my ears. And it's a day that helped shape who I am today. And the tragedy is not necessarily the people who died. The tragedy is not necessarily my father being shot or in prison, and being the only person in prison as a result of that night's violence. I mean, I firmly believe the tragedy lies in the fact that people don't know about that part of our history.
That was one of the things that, you know, of course, I've heard of you, sharing the story of the Orangeburg Massacre over the years. And why do you think it is that, you know, people all over the country, you know, we don't know about Orangeburg Massacre. We don't, you know, people don't know about, you know, what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with the massacre there. Why do you think that is? And how can we address that?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, we have to tell our own stories, because the stories that are told to us in our history books just are not, they don't tell a full picture of who we are. And so, you know, the Orangeburg Massacre is not in your history books. Tulsa is not in your history books. And we have to do a better job of of making sure we share those stories, pass them down from one generation to another. You know, most people found out about Tulsa from Watchmen, and they probably think it's not a real story, you know? And so I'm just happy that we've been able to educate people about things like Juneteenth, about things like Tulsa and the Orange Free Massacre, but there's so much more to our history that we need to know.
You mentioned the, you know, COVID-19 and that pandemic, and, you know, that really has showcased, you know, the disparities across our country when you think about housing and, you know, access to health care. And one of the things that, you know, I really feel like hasn't been discussed a lot is the impact that the pandemic will ultimately have on young people that already, you know, may be living in communities that, you know, don't have the greatest resources in their education system or don't have access to broadband internet and things like that. And, you know, we had these students that, you know, were forced to, you know, do distance learning because of the pandemic. Do you feel like there's something that, you know, will have great impact and we'll see that, you know, down the line, how that ultimately, you know, transpires?
Yeah, I mean, so that was a good question. That's one of those Chris Cuomo, Anderson Cooper questions. That was good. You know, the pandemic has shown us who we really are, the underbelly of poverty, the underbelly of racism, the underbelly of structural inequality and structural racism in this country. You know, I think that when you talk about communities like where both you and I are from, rural areas where you don't have access to certain things, you know, for example, living in a food desert or not having access to quality health care, or, you know, the list goes on and on and on. When you have a pandemic, it's no doubt, no question that you're going to die at higher rates, right? So, you know, the data is what we have now, which is unlike many other things that we have. Most times we don't have the data, but we have the data today. And I am I'm hopeful that because we have the data, we'll be able to get to a point where we can create the change we need based upon and come out of this better than we went into it. But I just don't know with this leadership we have.
One of my favorite parts of the book is the story you actually share about, you know, one of your childhood best friends. And can you share a little bit about that story?
About Pop?
About Pop.
Pop for me is a real hero. You know, I don't know if Pop is listening to this show or will listen to the show. I hope he does. But, you know, Pop is every bit a part of my life. He's a brother. You know, Pop literally grew up on the other side of the tracks. But even more importantly than that, Pop is someone who, means so much to me. He's a brother, and you know how Black families have brothers. We open our doors to so many people. He's somebody that, I love and I open my doors to, our family opened our doors to, and regardless of the difficulties he's made through his struggles and his triumphs, he's made it easier for generations after him.
Absolutely. And I felt that it was very honest for you to share kind of, you know, the trajectory that your life went on and, you know, kind of how, you know, the journey that Pop went on as well. And, you know, how, you know, he, you know, had some feelings about, you know, how, you know, your friendship, you know, turned out and, you know, how you had to, you know, address some things as well. And I feel like a lot of young people go through that, you know, you grow up with friends and, you know, it seems like, you know, life takes you down two different paths. What advice do you have for young people that, you know, feel like they are going down a different path through people that they, you know, have been like family to them?
Yeah, my whole thing is you don't get rid of people. You don't change friends, not true friends. Like people change draws, right? You keep them close to you. You learn from them. You know, Pop humbles me. He's known me for a very long period of time. He's somebody, no matter what I'm doing, when he calls, I answer, you know? And so my advice is you may go down different paths, but you don't have to forget people. Mm. People put in your life for a reason, and some people make you stronger. And Pop is somebody who definitely makes me stronger.
The making of a Morehouse man. Now, when I read this chapter, I was jealous the whole time. I'm like, I should have went through this. And the way you wrote it, the imagery throughout the whole book is just incredible. I know I was listening to an interview you did, and some the interviewer asked you about there not being pictures in the book. And it's funny because as I read the book, I was stopping and literally Googling pictures, you know, looking for pictures of your father and the things you described, and just to get, you know, even a clearer picture, even though you painted the picture so well.
Throughout. Well, you know, we actually had pictures in the book.
We had
8 pages of pictures in the book. We may actually put pictures back in there for the paperback version. But yeah, we had 8 pages, and the editor came to me and said, you know, you have painted such good images, you know, with the words, it's no real reason to put pictures in here. It will just take away and slow down the reader. And so we said, okay. But you're right. And there have been a lot of people to ask about pictures, and we may absolutely do that.
I'll be getting the paperback just for the pictures. But I wanted to talk to you about HBCUs, and I've heard you mention in several interviews, you know, you have 3 children. And,
yes.
You know, you say this with a laugh, that they can go to any college they want to, as long as it's an HBCU.
Correct.
And I know you mean that with every ounce of your being. It is not a joke.
That's right. I have choices. There are over 100 choices. The HBCU experience was so real. The HBCU experience, it taught me to be unapologetically Black. You know, it taught me the values of leadership. You know, the overwhelming majority of our Black professionals come from HBCUs. And so I know that many of them are struggling. And I, you know, I'm someone who always wants to lift them up and prop them up when I can.
We grew up around the same time. And I know we had back in the late 80s, early 90s, a sitcom, A Different World.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those of us that know that show actually increased the college enrollment rate of HBCUs. And I'm wondering if with the Black Lives Matters movement and just the sharing of different stories, I know that I believe Missy Elliott has shared that, you know, her mother didn't know about the massacre in Tulsa. Do you think that there's any part of what's going on that can lead to, you know, youth, you know, not only getting involved in the movement, but also enrolling in higher education institutes, particularly HBCUs?
I mean, I think you're starting to see that. You have Mikey Williams, who's the number one prospect in basketball over the next couple of years, talking about going to an HBCU you know, to play basketball. I think that things are changing. And so I truly hope that we begin to support and lift up our own and lift up our institutions of higher learning. I think that's the only way that we can quote unquote overcome.
Absolutely. So, while attending Morehouse, that actually, you know, was the beginning of your political aspirations or your career in politics. Can you share a little bit, you know, how that started and, you know, how it set the foundation for, you know, ultimately what you did politically?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Morehouse is a leadership institution, and we, you know, we don't necessarily value the quarterback as much as we do the SJA president. And I was just fortunate enough to be able to, you know, run for SJA president and win. And it just put me on a whole different leadership path. And I wanted to run for office. I knew that, but I had to order my steps, in the words of the gospel song, you know, order my steps. And I, you know, we started working extremely early when I was 18, 19 years old, my best friend Jared and I, and planning how we were going to run for office. And it worked. And I became the youngest Black elected official in the country.
And you shared that story in the documentary that you released a couple years ago. And I'm hoping that you will run for office again in the future, very near future, hopefully.
Yeah, certainly. We'll run again. You know, hopefully in Hopefully 22.
We would, I know all your supporters would love to see that and would love to donate to that campaign when the time comes. But I also, when I read this book, I had this thought in my head. You talk about in the book about, you know, being the voice of the voiceless and people that, you know, aren't able to be in, you know, rooms that, you know, you've been able to be in. And I can attest that every time you show up, whether it's on CNN or other platforms, that it's never about you. It's always about, you know, the people that you are representing, whether you're in office or not. And can you share how you developed that style or, you know, that leadership style?
Yeah, I mean, it came from Jim Clyburn and it came from Shirley Franklin. It's just for me a part of, you know, it's a part of being a part of something larger than yourself and staying humble. Like when our conversation about pop, you know, it's just about staying humble and just having an appreciation for those, understanding that you're not atypical. There's nothing special about me and you. We were just blessed and we took advantage of those opportunities. Our job is to create opportunities for all of those who didn't have them. And so that's how I feel. And that's where I am.
How do you, you know, handle, you know, when things are frustrating or, you know, when we see what happened to George Floyd and, you know, how, you know, emotional those things can be? How do you handle the weight of those situations, you know, in front of the camera?
This, I handle it one day at a time, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. You know, those moments are tough and they're hard and I'm emotional, but I handle it one day at a time. And I attempt to always speak my truth, always.
In the book, you talk about, you know, ultimately your desires that, you know, people will have freedom. What does that freedom look like to you? And, you know, like I said, you're the father of three children. You know, what is your hope for the nation and the world as we navigate these times?
Yeah, that's a really good question. But let's start with what does freedom look like? It looks like drinking clean water, breathing clean air, going to schools that are not falling apart, being able to attain the American dream, not just life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but also love, hope, truth, justice, and peace. You know, I have faith that we'll get there because I'm a faithful person, but we got a long way to go and a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. So before we wrap up, I cannot talk to you and not ask you any questions about politics.
Sure.
It's an election year.
Uh-huh.
And I want to talk to you about a couple of current events. So I'm not sure if you have seen the video. It was making its rounds this week with Kentucky and people being locked out of voting. How concerned should we be of a situation like that happening with, you know, less voting locations and problems with voting booths and voter suppression as we move into November?
You know how people say vote like your life depends on it. Well, this year your life truly depends on it. We're seeing over 100,000 people die because of ineptitude in Donald Trump. The problem is I don't want you to die while you're voting, right? So it's tough, but people, as we saw in Kentucky, people are not going to stop. People are going to show up to the polls. And I am, I just want to, we have to change leadership. If voting wasn't so important, people wouldn't work so damn hard to take it away from you, man. That's my philosophy about it. And we just have to continue to work to make sure that voting is things like a national holiday, that voting is easy and accessible. I think that should be our goals.
What are three things you feel like either Joe Biden or Democrats need to do to win in November? Top three things.
The top three things are college educated white women. 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. You got to nip that in the bud. 4 million people voted for Barack Obama. They didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. You got to crack that open. You got to message the black men, because black men, weirdly enough, can be a swing voter.
And how do you think, you know, Democrats should should address that or handle that?
I mean, a lot of it's just messaging and spending time and it's hard. Listen, I'm asking Democrats to do stuff that's extremely difficult during the Rona. Yeah. You know, the Rona would be great. So it's not like we can knock on doors. So I don't know what that looks like, but we'll have to see.
And lastly, how close do you think we are from our first female president?
President?
Yes, first female president.
Oh, 2024. I mean, I think you'll have a Nikki Haley versus Kamala Harris race. It'll be a hard race for Kamala to win. But I think that's when you'll get your first female president.
So lastly, I know you have a new project that is being released, I believe, next week, right? Next Monday, the 29th?
Yeah, next podcast. Monday is coming. We're on the ring. It's going to be good. I'll break this to you. Most people don't know. Our first guests are going to be Deshaun Watson, the quarterback for the Houston Texans, and my good friend Alan Cavana, who is the NASCAR reporter over at Fox. So we're going to have some good conversation.
Awesome. And what encouraged you to get back in, you know, into podcasting, and, you know, what can listeners expect from your new show? Because you had a podcast before.
Yeah. So we will be more bold this around. We'll be more bold in our guests. We'll be more bold in our conversation. We'll have more non-politicals talking politics. And we'll get ready for 2020 in a unique way. I think it's going to be a must. It's going to be a must listen. And watch.
Well, I know I'll be listening, and, you know, we're going to share with all of our listeners to listen to your new podcast.
Certainly.
And is there anything you want to share with our listeners before we end our conversation?
I'm all for it. I just want to say to your listeners that you are a dope individual, and I am really, really proud to be somebody who is growing in friendship with you, and whatever I can do for you, please add me to the list.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And to everyone, please go out, pick up your copy of My Vanishing Country. It's in bookstores everywhere. And we just want to encourage everyone to stay safe. And Bakari, thanks for your time.
Sounds good. Thank you, brother.
All right. Talk to you soon. It's time we stop waiting. We want to thank you for listening to this episode. We hope that you will join us and continue the conversation on our website at litandmore.com and on social media at litandmore. That's LITANDMORE. We'll talk to you soon. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave. Ain't nothing, no guarantee. You want it, you better bleed. And if you really feel like it's your calling, don't let it leave. Ain't nothing, no guarantee.